This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. This is a summer unlike any other. As the world copes with the worst pandemic in generations, our nation also wrestles with its legacy of racial divide. Recent events have underscored unresolved issues and systemic racism. Those of us who were born to the majority and the advantage that brings struggle to understand the experience of those who were not. Black Indian is a new book by Shonda Buchanan. It's a memoir about being African American with American Indian roots. As Wayne State University Press describes it, Buchanan and her family dealt with not just society's ostracization, but the consequences of this dual inheritance. Buchanan is a poet and educator and the literary editor of Harriet Tubman Press. She talks about her book and her life experience in an interview with Sarah Aronson, host of Montana Public Radio's The Right Question.
In the author's note at the beginning, you write, "This is not a scholarly book. It is a story, and I do not mean to offend anyone with it." I was hoping you'd just begin by reading the first chapter in the first section called The Red Black Heart.
Wait. To tell you any of these stories, I have to tell you the first. The very first. Somewhere in Mattawan, Michigan, there is an infant buried on top of a 13-year-old girl's grave. The infant, stillborn, was given a name anyway, but the wind buried the syllables under its cool tongue. The child's sutured eyes and never-kissed lips greeted the 1950s winter sky, the color of heron wings, when her father, my grandfather, opened another hole in the mute earth and laid his second unforgiving child's body to rest in her sister's slender waiting arms. Finally, someone to hold. Frida shifted and yawned into the earth. Together there, my two aunts, the virgin and the infant, kept each other safe. They shared the secret of each other's bones, and there were lots of secrets. Maybe I am the unborn child. Perhaps she returned in me to tell our story from my woman-child hands, Velma Jean's daughter's hands, fourth girl-child's hands, since we are, after all, the baby girls, and at once the sixth seed. We both prefer the dent of rain in the earth to the din of voices, the fists, the liquor laugh screams at family gatherings. Equally, we cherish our silence. And if I am her, what did I see hovering over the farm before the last mound of dirt covered me? What would I say first? Maybe something about the Potawatomi, the Odawa, and the Ojibwe, building wigwams on rivers, riverbanks, before French trappers, missionaries, and settlers came. Something about Mama's sweet cornbread and Daddy's cold beer. The five little burnished yellow Mattawan fairies. Mulatto skin. Pocahontas eyes. I would take you to the fields. To Wolf Lake. To the bait house. Push you on a tire swing, laced to the top branch of the weeping willow in the front yard. Push you until you were dizzy. And then I would say it. What I don't know, I can't tell.
What is it about knowing and telling that has been your guide, maybe all your life?
The telling has been, I realized as a writer, the telling has been survival. So I started writing after I read Harriet the Spy, right? Like a lot of young girls. And I realized that the things happening in my family weren't actually normal. I mean, there was something about it that was normal in terms of just being a child who grew up with the violence. But at the same time, that the natural inclination to hide when things happen, to save oneself, became a kind of lullaby, I think. And so writing was the thing that, the telling was the thing that actually helped me know. Yeah.
And this story begins at a funeral back home in Michigan where you've brought your daughter. And you write, "But grief for Velma Jean Stafford turns into fury, into mirthless laughter, then a small storm." And it was lines like these, this confluence of image and emotion, that really struck me. And I want to know about your ability to stare relationships and feelings right in the face.
That comes from my family. Everything was unvarnished. Everything was essentially up for ridicule. I'll say it like that. But at the same time, it was up for hard love. So we knew the love was there. And even as I'm speaking, I can hear my mom saying, "Shut up, Shonda," you know, because she would always say that to me. But I'm the teller. I'm the talker. I'm the questioner, right? So I think it just became this way for me to speak back to my mom, but with a sense of, "I love you, but there are things that I recognize that maybe you weren't able to protect me from because of how you grew up. But I'm going to do something different for my daughter. I'm going to do something different for me." And I vowed to do that. And the writing became this, writing this book and writing poems, my first book of poetry, Who's Afraid of Black Indians, became a way of naming certain aspects of the things that had happened. For instance, depression that my mother experienced, and that was evident through migraines that she had. I mean, just debilitating migraines. And then identifying violence, and then who the violence was happening, you know, to, and why that violence was happening, if there was a why all the time. And then also identifying molestation. And when the molestation happened to me, I blocked it out. I went to school with, after a molestation happened to me, I went to school and I'd started buttoning my shirts all the way up to the collar, and I stopped washing my neck. And one of my teachers came to me, Mr. Eaton, he came to me and he said, "What is wrong with you? Why you can't," he said, "this is pinching you." And I was like, "Don't touch me," you know? And so he called my mom and he was like, "Something's happening with her." But I didn't tell. I didn't say what happened. And then I forgot. It wasn't until I was 18 or 19, and it was like a watershed moment. It was like, "That happened to you." And I hear that with a lot of abuse victims and molestation victims, that their brain compartmentalizes it. And then it becomes a thing that didn't happen until your brain can handle it. And that's, again, when I started saying, "I need to write this. I can't be the only one in my family. Am I the only one in my family?" And there was a time I went to live in L.A. And I came back and I was angry. And I was like, "Who else did this man do this to?" And I was standing on the porch of our house. We lived on the east side of Kalamazoo, Michigan, Southworth Terrace. And my sisters, I think Tina, Rochelle, Bobby Ann were there. And I said, did Uncle Freed do anything to you guys? You know, what happened? And I'm the youngest. And suddenly it's like, you know, and my sister said something, but she didn't say the whole thing. Yeah.
And through the process of knowing and telling these stories, were you able then to link it to, you know, what we might call ancestral trauma, or, you know, generational trauma, the legacy of oppression and slavery? And
yes, everything for me. When I first started researching our family history in terms of that connection, the red-black connection, the African-American, American-Indian, European connection, and I started looking at the records, so a couple of things happened. Literally, I was going down one of the North Carolina census records, and I saw from a particular year, I don't remember the exact years now, but I saw from a particular year that there were black, Negro, slave, white, and then other. And I thought, okay, black, Negro, slave, white, other, and then mulatto, other, then colored. I was like, where are the Indians?
Yeah.
And I realized what it must have been like for the first peoples of this land to have been erased on paper, to have had their identity taken from them without any kind of discussion. Definitely war, definitely smallpox blankets, definitely Indian removal, the five civilized tribes who were on the assimilated Indians, you know, American Indians on the trail. But what was that like to kind of wake up one day and realize that you didn't have an actual place in this country? So that for me was a representation of trauma and rupture. And then when I would see, I guess another specific record actually, this is in a book called Southern Seed, Northern Soil. And it's one of the first books that talks about the migration of my Roberts people from North Carolina, Northampton, Virginia and North Carolina, Greenville, North Carolina, and how one of their lightest relatives would pretend like she owned the darker relatives so they could actually cross unmolested. And so when the bushwhackers came to say, hey, we want to take them, she was like, no, they're mine. Do you have papers? Why do I need papers? I'm a white woman just like you're a white man. And they would leave them alone and they could cross. Can you imagine like living with that sense of, it really feels like the border wars right now. It really feels like the taking of the children from their parents is a direct correlation to taking mixed blood kids from indentured servants, European servants who had kids with African slaves, and taking them and bonding them out, right?
Yeah.
As if the kids themselves have no value, no right to be with their parents. So when I see that, and I need to write an essay about that, but when I see it, I'm like, how come no one else knows this? There are historians in our country. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Library of Congress. How do we not know that history is reciprocal right now, and it's not to our benefit?
Author Shonda Buchanan in a conversation with Sarah Aronson, host of The Right Question. We'll have more of their discussion in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Bill Lester is among just 7 black drivers who have raced in NASCAR's top division during its 72-year history. He remembers driving at tracks surrounded by Confederate flags.
It was plentiful. That was just their culture. I didn't look at it as overt racism towards me.
How he views the significance of NASCAR moving to ban the Confederate flag on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Shonda Buchanan is the author of a memoir titled Black Indian. It's her story of growing up with a multiracial heritage. She was interviewed by Sarah Aronson, host of The Right Question.
Shonda, you write, Aunt Irma is standing at the kitchen sink now. Her breakfast dishes clink as she places them in, though she tries to move gingerly, but I can tell she is pissed to the highest passivity about something. And I was hoping you could just talk about anger and female anger and obviously this notion of black woman's anger.
Yeah. I think black woman's anger, I'll start there. We are the three tier. We are black, we are a woman, and we are an American. Historically, we have been black commodity. We have been economy, right? We have been the place that a seed was sown, the child was born, that child becomes property of someone. Traditionally, for that African side in this country. And so when I think about our physical body being a fertile soil only to take the seed from us, and possibly we could never see it again. You had to block that anger and that hurt and that pain. So the thing that occurred to us in historical times, that obvious trauma, that obvious sustainable, like we had to sustain ourselves. We had to continue to find some kind of love. And I literally believe that we are the backbone of this country. And I think nothing has gotten done unless there is a woman of color behind it making those plates spin. But at the same time, we don't get credit for it. Or we'll get credit for salaciousness or voluptuousness or the way we dance or our quote-unquote exotic beauty. We don't get credit for our intelligence. We don't get credit for our creativity. We don't get credit for just being a good person, right? Being a good person in America. So I think our anger stems from historical contexts of, you know, not being counted. I also think it comes from, I have to say that I believe in sisterhood, right? I always believe in sisterhood. At the same time, I know that as the quote-unquote mammy in a white woman's house, literally, some black women were doing everything, feeding their babies, sleeping with their men, cleaning their houses. We had the same anatomy as black women and white women, but there was such an animosity and a hostility. And sometimes for black women slaves, the white woman would treat them even more terribly. And it's like, but wait a minute, we can help each other. We can really raise each other's babies, you know? And I think that that sense of enemy, that feeling of being enemy has continued on throughout the generations. So now when we talk about anger as a black woman, I really think it is that sense of, you should count me in. I shouldn't have to force you to count me in. I shouldn't have to force you to see me in the grocery store. So I think there is that sense, we should definitely be more in lockstep. I think Alice Walker talked about that. I think Toni Morrison raised that question in her book, A Mercy, where there were triracials, black American Indian woman and a white woman, you know, working together at particular points in her novel. So anger as a woman, I think in this country, definitely now the lens turns to the man. And it is, how is it that you can keep all that power? How is it that you don't even recognize that you're keeping all of that power and then you're holding things back from everyone else who didn't start where you started? This makes us angry. This makes us furious, actually. And then to have a girl child and try to explain to her. So this is how it is in society, honey. But you should sit at that table anyway. Even if they are not going to think that you're as smart as you are. Even if they think that you don't have value, you know you have value. So make sure you're sitting at that table and make sure they see you in the grocery store. Make sure they see you everywhere in this world. It's interesting. I've started saying over the last year, because a lot of us have been thinking about the eradication of our rights, our civil rights, the eradication of our abortion rights, right? The repealing of citizenship. And so a lot of my friends are like, I'm leaving the country. I'm getting out of here. I can't take it. Nina Simone did that, you know, Richard Wright, all the, you know, the expats, Harlem Renaissance. But I said, this is my country. African Americans built it. We raised it alongside indentured servants, alongside whoever else was contributing. But our backs definitely built the bridge that capitalism is based on, right? And then on the American Indian piece, you know, this is my country. I have at least five nations in my blood on paper and the ones that I've traced. And I practice the ceremonies as well, right? I practice the traditions now. And I'm starting to tell people, this is our country. We should start thinking differently about it. Not just necessarily, this is America, but this is our country. And we have a right to stay. We have a right to be here. We have a right to fight in any way, shape, or form that we can fight. Yeah, this is our country. So for me, writing is fighting. This book is fighting. This book is, Black Indian is speaking back to the atrocities that we faced. It's speaking back to the trauma that historically society has rent on us, and then also what my family members have rent on us as well. So Black Indian is definitely a way of me fighting for selfhood, fighting for identity, fighting for my Americanness, you know, if I want to say it like that, my indigenous, fighting for those ancestors who came over on the slave ships. And the European ones that never showed up to any of my family reunions, but, you know, I know you're there, you're in my DNA. So for those who were less than, I think this book is a way of giving them voice.
There's a section in the book where you take on the fight in regards to raising a daughter, and I was hoping you would read that paragraph.
Yes, this is my Aunt Phyllis's funeral, and there are just so many, just an onslaught of emotions and people that I haven't seen in a while, and I'm bringing my daughter back. I'm a bit afraid because I don't want my daughter to suffer what I suffered. So this is just a paragraph interaction between myself and, or me thinking about the interaction that happened between my cousin and I. Mama, my daughter tugs my hand. Her olive, heart-shaped face turns up innocently. Who was that? A cousin. Someone I used to play with. But I don't blame Debbie Kay. I hesitate to introduce my precious daughter, too, because after the morning, maybe they will attempt to feed her meat, teach her cuss words I was forced to learn, invite her someplace where a fight would break out, and I wouldn't be there to drag her away. Maybe they'd try to claim her as one of their own. They would ignore my protests to keep her innocent. They might try to subsume her, get her high, tickle her till she pees on herself, laughing and crying at the same time. A lioness kind of mother, I couldn't let that happen. I might have to murder a family member behind that. Then we'd be having two funerals for the price of one. I had fought too long and too hard to leave the violence I grew up with behind. No one in L.A. knew what our hard love looked like.
Coming up, the conclusion of the Right Question podcast featuring author Shonda Buchanan talking about her memoir, Black Indian. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's budget director says the state remains on track to have a positive ending general fund balance at the end of the current two-year budget period. Joe Morissette told the legislature's Interim Government Finance Committee earlier projections had the bank balance at around $200 million on June 30th of 2021, the end of the biennium. But Morissette said the numbers reported in May were not looking good.
For the month of May, we saw sales tax that was short of the original legislative forecast by about 35% or about $27 million. So that's the worst month that we've seen. We would expect that to be kind of the bottom.
Those numbers were from April, and Morissette said those reflect the time when a number of businesses were shut down due to the pandemic. But he says it appears there has been some recovery, and if things hold true to forecast, the state will still have money in the bank.
I can't say for sure that we're the only state in the country where that's the case, but in the calls I've had with other state budget officers, I've heard of no one else who is at this point projecting a positive ending balance in their general fund. So it's great to be in that position as we're in the middle of the pandemic.
Morissette also told the committee the next state revenue forecast will likely be released in August. The number of DUI arrests in North Dakota have been dropping. The high for DUI arrests happened in 2012 when there was 7,382 arrests. In 2019, the number had dropped to 4,828. Here's Attorney General Wayne Stengem.
I think that's owed in part to the increased penalties, to the participation in the 24/7 program, and also I think society has started to recognize more than ever before that driving under the influence is a serious offense and is not regarded as something that is a joke or to be taken lightly anymore, that the risk to society is simply too great.
Someone who is sentenced to the 24/7 program has to check in twice a day, and if that person has consumed alcohol, the person is taken into custody. And promoters are closing in on a major hurdle that needs to be cleared before construction begins on the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. North Dakota lawmakers agreed to contribute $50 million from the state if the library boosters raise at least $100 million from private sources. Here's library co-ed, CEO Ed O'Keefe.
The TR library is very well on its way and quite confident that we will raise the funds before the end of the year and the next legislative session. So to make it clear, the question is not really whether we proceed. The question is whether North Dakota wants $200 million plus of private investment in the economy of the state.
O'Keefe says the library will generate jobs, diversify the economy, and help expand the state's tourism industry. The preferred site for the library is on U.S. Forest Service land in Medora. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And today we're sharing a discussion about memoirist Shonda Buchanan's book, Black Indian, which describes the multiracial heritage she cherishes and the struggles that came with it. She talked about her book with Sarah Aronson, host of The Right Question.
In the book, I felt like I was watching you make the move of ending the violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And I want to know, what does it take? It's like holding back a forest fire.
Yeah.
What does it take to say no more in this family?
That is so hard to answer, because I thought I had the answer after my Aunt Phyllis's funeral. And I thought, okay, I'm just surviving, like I'm treading water. We're here for the funeral. My daughter's here. I'm protecting my daughter. My daughter's with me. It's only 2 days. I can do this. So survival for me was treading water at first. And it was escaping to L.A. And I could recreate myself in L.A. I wasn't the granddaughter of Stafford's. I wasn't the granddaughter of Manuel's. Or I wasn't my mother's daughter in L.A. I could escape. I could just be me. But when I went home, I could feel the undercurrent just trying to, like the cartoon wisp, you know, cloud trying to come to me. And I'm like, no, I'm leaving. I'm on a plane. I'm running. So to manage that, definitely I would just seek out quiet places in my mom's home. Or I would jump in my rental car and I would just drive around Kalamazoo because it's so beautiful. I would drive back to my grandfather's farm in Manawan, where I used to pick blueberries. I would try to cull the beauty in my heart. Like, you love this place. You grew up here. Remember the horses. Remember the hay. Wolf Lake. I would go to Wolf Lake. And then I would go home. So I finally started saying, I literally started saying to my family members, are you okay? Remember when that happened? Like, just trying to, like, talk. Remember when that happened? Are you okay? So like little by little, I try to help them identify the things that I had already identified in writing so we could kind of heal a little bit together. And I would go back and start apologizing to them because I was trying to model a behavior. In therapy, you model a behavior, or, you know, in a relationship, and you say, you know, I'm sorry I did that to you. I wish, you know, that this would have happened differently. Or, mommy, I'm sorry, you know, that I was such a terrible daughter, you know, that I was always asking questions and that I asked you if I was adopted. And she was like, shut up, Shonda. Because I was like, I'm not like the rest of, you know, you guys. I'm not. I'm this sensitive kid who reads all the time and I write all the time. And you make fun of me for it. But I really started trying to show them the history of our family and to say, we come from triracials. We are some of the first free people of color to settle Indiana. This is our history. Some of the first free people of color to settle in Michigan. We're on the roster of the first free people of color families. This is our history, you guys. Look at this. We're on the African Cherokee rolls. When I brought the African Cherokee rolls to my family, and I said, look, our Roberts are here, our Staffords are here, our Manuals are here. They had no idea. So it gives them a different sense of pride, right? I think for me, pulling back the blanket of our heritage ignorance, our heredity ignorance, and then also kind of really trying to talk little by little about the trauma that had happened in our lives felt manageable to me, as opposed to just escaping and running away. And that's when I started telling people, I'm writing the family story. It's going to be good and bad. If it happened and I was there, there's a potential it's going to be in the story. but I'm writing it for a particular reason. I want to give this to my mom and my sisters and my aunts and my grandmothers as a kind of prayer that no one prayed for them. I want to give this to my brothers, and I'm working on a memoir that talks about the men in my family, because I think they had a whole different experience than what the women had in our family.
I'm so struck by your ability to stay in your family and tell the truth at the same time. What was it like for you to negotiate staying true to yourself and your experience and also managing all the other voices that might like to have a say?
The thing that really helped me continue on telling the story was ceremony. So I would write a thing, I would cry, and then I would burn sage and I would cleanse my space. I would write a thing, I would tell the truth. I couldn't believe that that thing had happened in my family. And I would try to tell it in a way that I was giving both the hard and the soft. And then I would go to a sweat lodge and I would cry and I would cry. There's a thing that we say in the sweat lodge. We pray to different directions. And the way that I learned it, the west direction, when you're sitting in a sweat lodge, the western direction represents transformation, death. It represents the threshold between the living and the dead, between beginnings and endings. And I was in the western direction in a sweat lodge at Mahutasan in the Los Padres National Forest. I must have sat there for 5 years. And then it was like writing and crying for 5 years and mending and band-aiding, putting band-aids on myself. And then I would come out, I would research, and I would write. And I would say, okay. And I would interview family members too. So it was a lot of I have to tell the truth to the best of my ability. I have to let people know this is my memory, this is a story that I am sharing, and that those other family members have their own perspective. But it was hard work. I'm always doubting myself that I did it right. I'm always doubting myself that, why did you share it? Why did you share that? You know, why did you tell that? And that's why when the thing happens with my mom, I put my aunt's verbatim interview in there because I didn't want to mess it up. And then I go back to the feeling of what that must have felt like as a young girl to have that moment, continually have that a moment. And I could just imagine how many young girls across our country, in this world. Michelle Obama is doing great work with her program, you know, instilling the value of a girl, right? Why should she have to do that?
Yeah.
Why don't we just cherish our daughters? Why don't we just cherish our nieces and our aunts and our sisters and just know that they've got this magic in them, right? Why don't we do that? And so, yeah, I think we say hashtag Black Girl Magic, you know, and we're trying to validate ourselves when we see each other. Ultimately, I want my daughter to know that she has value. And I think it was a dual thing, because I had her when I was young, when I was 21, and I was going through all of these like emotions and all of this past trauma, but I had a girl child. And suddenly it's like, how am I going to protect her? I remember one time going to her father's house. Her father and I weren't together. We didn't get married. And he was a rapper, and he had a house full of men. And I left. He was her father, and he was supposed to be there. But they were like doing music or whatever. And I left. I drove away, and then I came back. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, if any of you hurt my daughter, I will kill you. Have a good day. And they were like, she's crazy. But I was like, I know where you live, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I wanted my daughter to know that I would protect her no matter what.
Yeah. One of the things that makes you such a trustworthy narrator is at one point, or at multiple points, you call yourself an asshole.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know, what are you holding yourself accountable to?
Yeah. Good gracious. Yeah. I do feel like an asshole, you know, just kind of telling my mother's story. You know, I feel like an asshole touching their wounds and asking questions that they don't want to answer. And I feel like an asshole, particularly with my sister, Rochelle, and just really not being the one who could save her from whatever the ghosts and the trauma was. And I felt like the only way that I could get around that feeling of accountability, like the sense of that I have to share this in a way that it shows that I'm taking responsibility for the information that I'm sharing. And it also shows that I am deathly afraid at every step of the way of the information that I'm sharing. But at the same time, I am taking a stand against everyone who has hurt a woman in my family in a way, in any way, when they should not have. So at every point, a narrator is not God, but a narrator is the one who is quote-unquote empowered with the telling of the thing, but we also have the responsibility to, who said it, we are, I forget which, if it was Alice Walker or Lucille Clifton said, when someone gives you their story, they give you the poison, but they also give you the medicine. Like they're giving you the hard thing that happened, but then they're telling you on that backside how to heal it, right? And I feel like a part of this book is definitely so hard, like there's a lot of poison in it. But I'm also telling you how to heal us, how to heal myself.
In the book, you talk about being a child who loved to run. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about Michigan and the land and the places that you love, your body came alive. And I was hoping that you could talk about what it means to be Black Indian, and how you live in your body and how you inhabit a physical landscape.
Yeah. What it means to be Black Indian in America for me means taking ownership of my physicality in terms of my ability to wear things that represent my culture, and then to share that. My being Black Indian, I feel, allows me to participate in ceremonies on both sides. So I am a women's traditional dancer. I dance powwow. I've danced powwow for 12 years. I've sang on American Indian drums. It allows me to participate in that culture and to celebrate and honor and share that culture. And then I also danced West African dance for 10 years. It allows me access to Africa, you know, and to channel my ancestors and to be a whole person and to walk in this society with a sensibility that I am rich in culture. I'm not deprived. There is not a deficit in being Black in America. There is not a deficit in being multiracial in America, even though the expectation is that, or the news tells us that, and statistics show us that, in terms of the Black Lives Matter and, you know, the amount of Black men and women who have been murdered by, or shot by, or hurt by white police officers. And it says the narrative, the America's public narrative says being Black in America is being less than. Being Indian, American Indian in America is being less than. And we have less resources, yes. But culturally, we are rich. And I get to have that. James Baldwin said in one of his interviews, he said, and the interviewer asked him, "You were born Black. You were born poor. You are gay. You must feel awful. And James Baldwin said, I hit the jackpot. He said, and he started laughing. He said, I hit the jackpot. Look what I get to do. I get to talk back to the oppressor. I get to talk about what it means to be Black in America. And for me, I get to talk about and I get to share what I have learned on what we call the Red Road to the best of my ability. And then we always say, I don't mean to offend anybody, because there were over 500 American Indian nations in this country before the wars depleted them, right? And now they're in Indian territory, most of them, I shouldn't say, but they were removed to Alabama and Oklahoma. And we still have American Indian nations all across this country on state-recognized lands and reservations and federally recognized reservations. But we, and I speak from the American Indian side, we are not in the public limelight. We're here. You won't see us until we actually have to protest, like a Dakota, you know, line going through our lands. And then we go back to the reservations and then people forget about us until something else happens and you're encroaching upon territory that was supposed to be ours. But we're here. We're actually probably sitting next to you. And unless you ask, you don't know. So I feel like being Black Indian in America, so forgive me, my Black people, Black power, you know, I am a proud Black woman, but I feel like being tri-racial, that I represent the real American story. And I know we say that until America deals with slavery and the schism that slavery caused in our fabric, in the fabric of America, in the tapestry of America, we won't really ever be right as a country, right? But I also feel like until we really highlight and explore and share in our public schools, in our educational system, how this country was built by everyone who came here, and then who participated and contributed in the building in a specific point in time, then we really won't know the whole story of America. We have to really start talking about all those strains that came and created this country. If we can actually say, who's sitting at this table? Or who should be sitting at this table that's not at this table? Why do I not recognize this as a white person in America? That in my magazine, the only people of color who are Black are in ads, and I'm not telling any stories about Black people or people of color. How can we filterate that? How can we infiltrate that kind of sensibility that people of color, multiracial, Black Indians are here and our stories are valid? We've got multiple narratives that need to be told, and it always becomes a side story. And it's interesting too, because when I start listing the people who claim their Black Indian blood, like Beyonce, Black Indian Irish, like James Earl Jones, who did the first Black Indian movie video, Alice Walker, who talks about that in Temple of My Familiar, Crispus Attucks, the first Black man, they say, to die in the Revolutionary War, was actually African, and Nagaratsat, his mom, was American Indian. Mildred Loving, who was the woman who, they said, Black woman with her white husband who repealed the interracial marriage law. But Mildred Loving, her grandson, said, wasn't actually Black. She was Rappahannock. But they don't want to say that they're Indian, because then it says, well, who are her people? Where are her lands? Her lands are gone, you know, or her lands have been encroached upon, or her traditions have been taken from her. So she's been relegated to only colored or only Black. And I think that's a part of my fight here, too, is to say, I am rich in my culture. We are rich in our history. This is the dream. If we teach our kids, if we can instill that in our kids, then maybe we can make different choices for ourselves in this world. And so that's what I'm trying to do with everything that I write, but definitely with Black Indian.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this, and I appreciate it.
Sarah Aronson, host of Montana Public Radio's The Right Question, in a conversation with Shonda Buchanan, author of Black Indian. The book was published in August 2019 by Wayne State University Press.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 23rd. The Central Racing Circuit of North Dakota met early in 1909 to organize for their annual horse races. All reports suggested the upcoming season would be a highly successful one. Exciting news for North Dakota, which newspapers noted had a reputation as a racing center. This race group also garnered attention because, quote, its organization was said to be well-nigh ideal. The locations for the series weren't too far apart, making it easier and safer to ship horses between venues. This year, Fargo joined the other 8 cities that were already members of the Central Racing Circuit. In order to participate, Fargo had to sell 2,500 tickets and send a delegate to attend the organizational meeting that had been held in February. 1,800 of the tickets were sold before that meeting, so there was no concern on that end. Consequently, Fargo became one of the stops and would host 3 races over 3 days and a purse of $400 to the winner of each event. The Fargo Forum reported, "The Horse Review refers to the Central Circuit of North Dakota as easy purses. Possibly it meant to say early purses. Some of the boys from the South didn't find them so easy last year." On this date, Minot kicked off 3 days of races and then sent the competitors on to Rugby for the next event. The Stutzman County Fair in Jamestown featured horse racing along with its other fair amusements. Golden Valley noted at the end of the season that their resident, quote, enthusiastic racehorseman, unquote, S.M. Wills, returned with some spoils of the sport, having won 4th place in each heat in Fargo and first money in every race he entered in Castleton, Courtney, and Carrington, as well as picking up a few first-place finishes in the other towns. In the meantime, Mr. William Parker of Minot would say, "I have owned my last racehorse. There's no money in it, and to be successful, you've got to associate with crooks and be one yourself. I don't care if you have a pick from 1,000 boys to ride your horses. There's not one of them but who can be bought to throw a race. I'm sick of the whole works." Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. With the few minutes we have left today, we're going to talk about the passing of a remarkable North Dakotan, Sister Thomas Welder, who passed away Monday at the age of 80. And our news director, Dave Thompson, joins us to talk about what was a remarkable life, Dave.
Absolutely a remarkable life. A person who had been president of the University of Mary when it was Mary College. She started out there in 1978 and served until 2009. That made her the longest serving woman president of a university in the country. So that was one of her accomplishments. But really, everybody talked about what a go-getter she was, but really a very nice person and a very knowledgeable person. As a matter of fact, one of the people who graduated from University of Mary, who's a good friend of mine, said she was scary smart. That's how people thought of her. And one other thing that she had this knack of, she met you, she remembered you. So that was one thing everybody thought was so remarkable about Sister Thomas. She remembered people, and she was unfailingly willing to greet you when you saw her and just was really engaged with what you're doing.
Well, I certainly knew about her history with the University of Mary and the remarkable progress that that institution made under her leadership. And
yes.
I remember her getting the Theodore Roosevelt Rough Rider Award, which is the state's highest honor. But what I didn't know until I read her obituary was that she had a bachelor's and master's degree in music and that there was a great love of her life.
It was, and as a matter of fact, early in her career, before she became president of the University of Mary, she was teaching piano lessons and some other music lessons. Several people I know went through her classes in piano and really appreciated her and her artistic ability and her ability to try to get you involved in the music. And it was really, really quite interesting.
And she was Sister Thomas Welder, a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Annunciation Monastery in Bismarck. So she lived those values.
She definitely lived those values. Remember, Benedictine values are charity and welcoming and very much collaboration. They're all there. And you could tell that in the way Sister Thomas treated her faculty, Sister Thomas treated her students, and the people from outside the university who came to visit.
And truly a North Dakotan, born in Linton, spent much of her life in the Bismarck area, and again, remembered very fondly as a very important person in the history of our state. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Doug.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
Uh-oh, the kids are stuck home? Well, there is some help. Prairie Public reminds you about PBS Kids. It's on the television, but there's also pbskids.org, where you can find all kinds of educational and fun games and activities. pbskids.org or PBS Kids on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that as we broadcast across North Dakota, we stream around the world from prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street program at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, we'll feature another one of the finalists for the Midwest Book Awards. It's Stringing Rosaries, The History, The Unforgivable, and the Healing of Northern Plains American Indian Boarding School Survivors. It was written by Denise Lajamadir and published by the NDSU Press. The book tells the stories of 16 people who attended an Indian boarding school. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.